Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, I said like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
Nick Hornby joins me on this episode of Wheels Off, all the way from London, a transatlantic trunk call, as it were. He is one of my very favorites. I've read every novel he's written. I met him after he included me a mention of some of my music in his book, 31 Songs, that appears in the U.S. as Songbook. Some kind words, and we've stayed friends over these last 18 years or so. He's the best. He's a champion of music. He loves music. He writes about music with an authenticity that you don't often find. He's branched out from just writing. Obviously, he started with books that were more memoir and then has written great fiction over the last two decades plus. He's written lots of funny essays, lots of really beautiful, insightful stuff. He's been living in the world of film and television more in the last, 5 years or so. And it's just, he's a good dude. He's a great guy. He thinks about this job. You can tell during the interview you're about to hear, that he has a lot of gratitude for the success he's had. And he just works really hard. It's not an accident that he is at the level that he is. He's got talent, but he's also got work ethic. And when someone has those two things in the amounts that Nick Hornby does, he's not stoppable at that point. I'm so lucky to get to talk to Nick Hornby, and I feel like you're pretty lucky to get to hear this sweet conversation. Please welcome to Nick Hornby, Jesus Christ. Please welcome to Wheels Off, the great Nick Hornby. Welcome to Wheels Off, Nick Hornby. How are you? Thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rhett. It's nice to see you.
Oh, this is great. For the edification of our listeners, where are you right now speaking to us from?
I'm in Islington, North London, watching the most incredible, miserable downpour.
Wow, that sounds very Islington. It's funny, knowing you, I don't have any idea what the answer is going to be to this question, but what creative project are you working on at the moment, and how is it lighting you up?
I am writing a little book about Prince and Dickens. That's Prince, the musician, and Dickens, the novelist. When that Sign of the Times box set came out last year, and there were something like 63 new songs from those sessions, as well as the double album, And it struck me that Prince may be the most creative musician that's kind of lived in our lifetimes anyway, that he never, ever stopped either recording or playing. And pretty much the only person I could think of who did that was Dickens. So I started to think about the two of them and started to see things that interested me. Like, they both died pretty much in their same year, 58, 59. Probably work killed them in one way or another. They both grew up poor, like properly poor, and, you know, Dickens famously was sent to work in a blacking factory by his parents when he was 12, 13. And Prince had quite a checkered childhood, I think. And there was other stuff, like movies were really important to them, even though Dickens never knew it, right? Prince wrote and Purple Rain, made Purple Rain the movie and the album when he was 24, and that's when Dickens wrote Oliver Twist. And both came to kind of define who they were later on, I guess. So anyway, I'm having fun with it.
That's kind of the perfect Nick Hornby project in a way, because it's the marriage of music, which has been such a through line in your work.
Yeah.
And really, that's how you and I first met, was after 31 Songs, a songbook in the U.S.
Yeah.
But I'm of all the writers I know, you've done such a great job of loving music and treating it lovingly. And when you write about musicians and people who love music, you do it in such a realistic way, which is so hard to get right.
Well, it's easy enough, I think. To write about people who love music and to whom it means a lot. I think probably the hard thing is to step outside sometimes and describe what it feels like and looks like. But yeah, this Prince Dickens thing is a lot of fun. And even though I thought I knew quite a lot about Prince, the albums that have kind of started to appear or never properly appeared, or there are just millions of them, and you know, the ones he made for other people, and that just constant creative process. And when Prince was making Sign of the Times, he was making three records at once that were all supposed to be incredibly different, and the record company in the end insisted that he boiled it down to this double album. And of course, Dickens wrote two books at the same time for the first three or four books, because of the serialization. I mean, who can do that? So he's finishing the part work of one and beginning the other. So he's got two sets of characters in his head, two plots in his head. He's really writing off the cuff. He's just riffing. And these books have been preserved for 150 years. It's kind of amazing.
You're one of the few people I know that's been able to do, obviously, all the writing, but is music as well. You've written songs and stuff, and I wonder, when your experience with writing music, how much different has it been? How easy/hard has it felt? Does it feel natural to you?
Well, I wrote an album with Ben Folds, mm-hmm. and he suggested it. Well, actually, first of all, he asked me to write a couple of songs for his William Shatner album that he produced. And so that was how I was kind of eased into it. And that was one of the weirdest, funniest experiences, where I'm on the phone to William Shatner. He's trying to get me to write some other things. He wanted me to put my stamp on some personal lyrics that he had. And and I said I couldn't go there, that they were too personal. But I did write these character songs for him. And one of them was great, I think, or turned out great. Amy Mann sings back up, and Ben sings back up, and Bill does his thing, you know, spoken word thing. So Ben said, well, why don't we try it together? And I just remember for that period, every time I had an idea about anything, I thought, okay, that's a song idea now. And once I'd started thinking in that way, they came pretty quickly. Little short stories that would never sustain a novel, but would be maybe okay for a song lyric. And also, I think I had to do something that was kind of third person, and really make an effort. Otherwise, there's no value in me at all. If I sent Ben a love lyric saying, oh, I love you, and because he'd think, well, you know, what's the point of this? So it had to be something that was imaginative, I think. And so there are little short stories and so on the record. But one thing I really noticed is if you ever wonder whether lyrics or the tune is more important, it's the tune. I mean, I think we all know that songs we love that haven't got the best lyrics, but I don't think we know any songs we love that haven't got a great tune. And when I sent these lyrics off to Ben and they came back as songs, they'd been completely transformed.
Oh my God. That is so cool. I wonder about Juliet Naked, because there were a lot of snippets of lyrics, obviously a lot of song titles in that book. Were you thinking kind of in that way? Were you imagining entire songs? How much did you get?
No, not really. I just imagined as much as I needed to imagine, really. I could kind of hear the music in my head. I mean, the genre, the style of music it was, the feel of it. But I didn't write the whole song. And a couple of other people have had goes at that, and that's kind of fun as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of them. Oh,
you had to go for the movies, yeah. But one guy made an album, you know, like beginning to end of the songs described in the book, and that's kind of cool as well.
That's amazing. I think I probably wound up with about 6 or 7. I just couldn't stop. You told me to stop after like 2.
Yeah, they were great as well.
they were pretty great.
Yeah, they were great.
I wonder, so like, I really love how obviously your early work really feels like there was so much of the young Nick Hornby in that stuff. I wonder, do you remember the very moment when it was clear to you that you were going to be a writer? Was there an epiphany moment as a kid that you knew you were going to do this for the rest of your life?
I don't think anyone's got the nerve to think that, have they? I knew I wouldn't ever be able to stop it, probably, but whether anyone would pay for it was another question. And I'm kind of lazy as well. The first time I tried to write, I had to give up my job. I was teaching in high school, and I did have an idea that kind of kept me awake at night, thinking, no, I've got to do that. And so I handed in my notice, and for the next few years it was sort of a mix of teaching and writing, but I never had the nerve to call myself a writer because I had nothing to show for it. So I don't think it was until High Fidelity came out and was successful that I thought, oh, now I know I will be a writer, because I'd written something that I'd invented, and I thought, I can do that again. If you can make something you've invented work, then you can do that again. My first book was a memoir, Fever Pitch, and I thought, well, I can't, you know, I've not got another memoir in me, and now I'm going to have to start thinking about other people, even though I went slowly, because High Fidelity was half me anyway. And then it got more and more fictional after that.
When you were really like a school kid, was there stuff where you would write? Did you write short stories? Were you always doing this?
No, never. I went to a really uncreative, old fashioned English boys' school. I mean, I'd say in the 70s, there were lots of single-sex schools. And I went to a what you'd call a public school, but you had to pass an exam to get in. And once I got there, it was grammar, parsing sentences. There was no creative work involved at all. And all my dreams of creativity came through my own reading and music, basically. And those were the two things that made me creative, but my education had nothing to do with it. And if anything, it retarded the process.
The characters in your books wrestle with demons a lot. Like, there's a lot of interior life that goes on. There's a lot of acknowledgement of the internally generated obstacles that we all set for ourselves, the problems that we invent. And I wonder about, for you, what have you figured out as far as ways around those, ways to push through these internally generated obstacles?
Therapy. I'm a big fan of therapy. I think everybody should have it if they can afford it. And you've got to choose somebody who's smarter than you with a really good memory. And I've got exactly that guy. It's interesting you say that because, you know, I think it's true, those internally generated obstacles. And I think in the last few years, maybe, I've written more about women. Mm-hmm. I wrote three movies, really, about women, which was An Education of Wild and Brooklyn. And one of the things that attracted me to them is that the obstacles were from outside, you know? And if you're writing about a guy of our age or, you know, any kind of middle-classish white guy who has problems, those problems are always self-generated. There's nothing stopping us. and that's kind of, after a while, I think I don't want to write about self-generated problems anymore, not least because if there are proper obstacles in someone's way, it increases the chances of you being able to find something dramatic happening to them. And it's kind of, you know, it's easier in a way to write about actual problems in someone's path. So I loved writing those movies and it gave me a lease of life, I think.
I thought, just like you, the latest was kind of a nice marriage of the two, right? There's a lot of female perspective. There's a lot of internally generated obstacles. Then obviously the more societal, external stuff.
I mean, I wanted to write as much as anything. I wanted to write about my country and what's been happening here over the last 5 years. The sort of catastrophe of Brexit, and which I still think was a catastrophe, and time I think will probably prove us right. Those who think like me. But the complicated thing about it is that my own side got me really, really pissed off. And I think something like it happened in America, that you listen to too many people say, well, they're just dumb. And it doesn't really help or get anywhere. And I got sick of listening to the same voices saying the same things all the time. And always in any kind of fiction or art, I think, you're trying to see the other person's point of view. So I know why some people voted for Brexit. And that book helped me to understand that and putting myself in that position. But of course, the truth is that when it's big, complicated economic decisions like this, nobody understands anything properly anyway. So it becomes like an article of faith. And I think that what Brexit did was create Protestants and Catholics in a fairly irreligious country, actually.
It was really well done, because it's funny, if someone hadn't read that book and they heard you describe it just now or talk about it just now, they might think that it's, you know, upfront very much about Brexit, when it's very much sort of a love story that's couched in that environment. And it's great, because it's funny, because the way it works in terms of the Brexit argument for and against is echoes sort of the love story, because you think you're very different. You think you come from these different backgrounds. You think you have different lives, and in the end, you're way more similar than you realized.
Yes, and obviously that was something that attracted me, that if you're kind of hitting people face on all the time, politically, and over again, just butting heads, you think maybe there's a way around the back somewhere to make connection. And that was what I wanted to explore. And so much of our relationships are about humor and chemistry and stress and stress levels and who's got the right energy for you. And of course, politics is going to be a part of that. And there are certain people I know I couldn't ever have a relationship with, but within quite a broad spectrum, I think. And I think what saves both of them in the book is they're both doubtful. They both have doubt about their own positions, or they don't even know if they've got a position. So it's not like one votes Brexit, one votes Remain, and yet somehow true love prevails. Neither of them are that sturdy, I think.
So in a moment, I will ask you to sort of come up with a nugget of wisdom that sums up all of this stuff we've talked about. But before that, I will ask my editors to take a short break as we go to a commercial. And we're back. So I wonder if you, because you, like me, have kids that are entering adulthood. I guess the younger versions of your kids are just coming into this. And I wonder if you were to meet a younger version of yourself, like a 21-year-old Nick Hornby, but working in today's world, what advice might you give yourself?
Well, I think the thing I needed to know was when I was a young man, was that I was as talented as everybody else. I'm not interested in more or less, but I always felt that it was a parallel universe, the creative universe, and I would never be able to cross the tracks and get to a place where you're working with creative people and making your living that way. And once the switch happened, I was kind of amazed, but looking back, maybe I shouldn't have been as amazed as I was, if you see what I mean, that there was talent in there. So I think any kind of way of giving confidence and self-belief to young people, it's really about, well, a lot of it is about how much you want it and how much time you're prepared to spend doing it. Because it's the same in your world. You can go into a bookstore and you look around and there are books in there by people who I think can't write a word, you know, can't string a sentence together. But there they are, they're in the bookstore, and then books that are being ignored, written by people who are geniuses. And it's a pretty big world, the writing world. It's not like this is the quality you have to get to. There are all sorts of quirks and flukes and ways around it. But if you haven't got anything to show for it, you know, if you're not doing the work, then you're out of the race anyway, if you see what I mean. So it's about working every day, I think, and getting something done every day.
I don't know that even knowing the sometimes the tortured nature of your protagonists, I don't know that I would have guessed that you in your earlier years suffered from that feeling of, I don't know if you would characterize it as this, but like an imposter syndrome, or like you weren't as good as.
Yeah. I mean, worse than anyone's, I don't think. It was terrible. It was terrible. It wasn't even a doubt. I was convinced I was an imposter.
That's fascinating to me because you're so good.
Well, I can remember it was a friend of a friend, and he was like a young movie producer. And I think my sister knew him and said, oh, Nick wants to write. And we went out for a drink, like some media hangout where I'd never been before. And he said, well, have you got any ideas? And I had a few things to tell him. And he said, yeah, great. We can definitely do something with that. And then we walked out of this club and walked into someone coming the other way who this producer knew. And he said, oh, this is Nick Hornby. He's writing something for me. And I wanted to die. I thought, this is what people do. You know, that I was suddenly a writer because this guy had said I was a writer, but I wanted the ground to swallow me up. I'd written nothing. He'd produced nothing. And I thought, oh, this is a world entirely based on bullshit. But it didn't help me. But I still get it. I think everything, you're at year zero. You are not only as good, you're not as good as your last thing, you're as good as the thing you're doing now. And I think that probably helps to keep you working hard.
Yeah, I've wondered about that. I mean, I've never had a big hit, and I've wondered if that has helped make me hungry in a way that I wouldn't be if I had a ton of external validation. Like, I constantly want to prove myself. It sounds like you've got that as well.
Yeah, I do have that as well. And, you know, at least in this country, my first two books were big hits, and then High Fidelity did okay in America as well. But it never made any difference to me. I mean, partly I thought, well, if I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, then you really have to get over the hit. You have to do something else. And I was writing a bit about this in The Prince and Dickens, actually. But one of the things that becomes clear with both of them is that they're not perfectionist in any way. I mean, if you're working on three things at once and releasing as much as they're releasing, you're just get it out there. And of course, it helps if you're that talented. But when you think of the tragedy of somebody like Harper Lee, who could never bring herself to write a second book, I do think that's a creative tragedy, actually, that if she'd got straight on with another novel or whatever it is she wanted to do and got it out there, then you're over To Kill a Mockingbird and you've got the rest of your life. But she could never bring herself to do it. I guess Salinger was like that to a certain extent. I don't know what his story was, why he didn't publish again, but I think he was freaked out by the success of the first one. And I have a long life to fill with my work, and I'd hate to think that I'd written the best thing. I still think the best thing is still to come.
Well, you seem like you keep getting better to me, and I'm so glad I get to know you, and I'm glad I've gotten to pick your brain for this Wheels Off. Thank you so much for joining me, Nick Hornby.
That was a pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris. Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolfpack, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to the show on the road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.